Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
Hello, and welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with today's design leaders, practitioners, alumni, to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Caligaris. I'm the Vice President of Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute and your host for today's episode. And today we are extremely excited to have with us Brett McFarlane, who is an organizational consultant focused on leadership development for creative and design organizations. And we are going to have a great conversation. I've had the pleasure of talking to Brett before, but thank you, Brett, for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you, Rebecca. And it's wonderful to see you again. And I love this podcast and that you go behind the work to the people and their experiences doing the work.
Absolutely. All right. For those who haven't had the pleasure of talking with you, Brett, let's start with just a little bit of background. What's your journey into design and why you are so passionate about leadership and what you do?
Oh, the journey in design. That's always a wonderful meandering question, isn't it? My journey is, maybe if I make step back and make sense of it, it was always and has been and is guided by three principles. You could call them life design principles or career design principles, really of the red threads of empathy, intent, and compassion. And whatever field of the creative industry or design, whatever industry or whatever objective, those have always really driven towards the outcome of improving lives, whether that's end users or people within organizations, which is where I focus now. And the journey for me, if you think of design as a mountain, I've climbed that mountain three sides. And the first one, which was the first chapter, was very much all about the user. And I started really hands-on tools. I had a little action sports design studio in Whistler, BC, doing graphic design work. But I quickly evolved into being energized by the strategy side and the business side. So I was, before business design was a thing, that's what energized me. And I was able and fortunate to have roles in full-service global creative agencies working with big brands like Unilever and Visa. And as privileged to see all aspects of the creative industry at the highest level in different markets. And that was very much my strategy and business focus side of the design mountain. The second chapter, which is partly, I think, my favorite chapter in a way, was when it became all about the designer and the products they create. And the products they create is very much around the process and the culture and the environment. And I was very fortunate to have experienced it to exceptional boutique studios working on building great teams and doing fantastic work and creating great cultures, firstly around Us2, which was in the middle of the last decade, a very seminal mobile design firm. And I was setting up leading teams and our work with companies like Barclays and American Express, British Telecom, Apple Watch, which we'll talk about in a second, and others in healthcare and sports. That was really modern product development methodology, bringing strategy into that, starting to bring empathy into the actual process around how do we create products. And how do we create legacy? How do organizations change to enable new forms of logic and value? And the second part of that chapter was at Method, which some may know, having come out of San Francisco, which was arguably in the aughts, sort of if not the most influential digital design studio at that time. You know, huge amount of Google's work came out of Method up in, you know, the last couple of decades. And in that, I led a multi-year transformation of a corporate that we had shared ownership, where we used design as the lever for transformation from everything from, yes, doing the actual design work all the way through to how do we develop capability to how do we evolve the strategy and a lot of leadership development work. And that really is where I started to pivot into leadership development and the strong belief that as you develop better leaders, you develop better cultures and better capability and space for great design to come out. And that's when I started my third chapter, which is where I am now, which started a few years ago, where it's all about leaders and culture. And that's in my work, which I frame it under leadership development, but I work with leaders in high innovation situations where they're dealing with a lot of uncertainty and often leaders who have not had any leadership experience or leadership training, which is shockingly common in the design field. And, you know, it's a different topic as to why that is, but there's a lot of leaders, and we'll talk about what I mean by leader, but I actually think all designers are leaders of a form. But there's a lot of designers, when they get into more senior roles, leading teams, leading departments, leading companies, leading strategy, they have not been prepared for what that is, unlike other disciplines in the world of business. The good news is it's not a big mountain to climb, but it's a valuable mountain when we do start to climb it. And so that's where I work. I also research this field, and I do research out of INSEAD around the psychodynamics and behaviors of leadership in high risk, high reward, and high emotion situations, which is what innovation is. And often driven by design, whether that's digital design or more traditional R&D, research and development design.
Such a valid point that is, there are so many more emotions, there's so much more possibility, and there's often more tension in those areas where designers are really putting through, that it puts like an extra need on their ability to lead.
Exactly, extra need. And I think that that's where the good news is, there's a lot of evidence and ways of how to thrive under those situations. And the wonderful thing is a lot of core design practices actually link really naturally. Mm-hmm. But we often haven't made that link. So things around empathy for others is such a powerful design capability that either you apply it into the organization or apply it onto yourself, it really generates powerful changes and impact through culture and also an individual's capability to drive influence and help others collaborate and help others feel empowered and join into the process of whatever challenge it is that you're solving.
I think that's such a good point. And I think it'll be a common theme as we go through here, right? That much of what makes a designer's a good leader is really leveraging the core sort of superpowers and skill sets that makes them good designers. It's not necessarily a totally different function you need to learn. It's about how do you use those skills you already have to do this part more effective.
Exactly. And either shift the focus of where or the level of interrogation or application of where you're applying them, and including yourself.
Which I think is super interesting, because one of the ways you talk about that is like, okay, I'm going to use my super myself, which is thinking about personas. And I know you've spent some time thinking about your persona, and I think that's great. And I also think it will help people understand you even more as we go forward. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the persona of Brett?
The persona of me. So me as me, I describe as a coach to innovator leaders in design technology, right? And my goal is to produce society's most impactful innovation leaders. And how I go about doing that is through my one-on-one coaching, training, facilitating leadership, assessing culture. But a big part of it is my own self-awareness of how I show up and what I do and my own knowledge of how I respond to situations. And that digs down into my personal values, which is, for me, it's very important to be quite courageous, to see challenges, but also take intentional action. It's also important to be adventurous. I'm just wired that way. I have an innate curiosity and intrinsic motivation. Now that I know that, I understand why I get really frustrated in situations where we aren't going a bit out of bounds. And I can be a lot more compassionate to other people because I realize it's my problem sometimes. Other times, it's empathy to understand why other people are comfortable. But because I have that awareness of that driver in my persona of a seeking adventure, I can use that as a superpower for good. Because of course, a superpower can be used for good or for evil. And therefore, I like to use mine for good. And the last one for me is grace, and being very gracious and very humble and respectful and polite. I've just found, and the good news, again, the research tells us, is that is often the most effective way to drive change and innovation in organizations.
Yeah. Change is very rarely like bulldozed through. Right. And it often is it's also frequently not like decreed through, right? It's not because I had authority, I could make change, right? It can come from all different levels. And one of the things I think is interesting when you talk about leadership, and you said like all designers have some form of leadership that they're required to do. It's not just, hey, if you want to get a promotion, you need to be good at leadership. Leadership as a skill helps on every aspect of your role and the type of change that you can create in an organization.
Yeah. And leadership is in your role. It's also a systemic mindset is helpful to think depending where you are in your career. Early on, when you're a sole contributor member, you have a leadership role as a member of a team. At times, the team will call on you. We need your expertise to solve this, or you will contribute. Hey, I think there's a better way or a different way, or I did this thing. I know it impacts you this way. So leadership is the act of driving change. That's what leadership is, driving change with others. Right? It's not just a one-way thing. It's a two-way thing. So at an individual level, then as you become responsible for a team, then that becomes a shared leadership function where you're accountable for the whole team. You're not just a member, you are also responsible and accountable. You have pastoral care for the team. And so your role shifts to not just worry about your position, but also other people's position. And then as you elevate beyond that, then you know the level of leadership moves into less around solving the problem, but enabling other people to solve the problem, how you support them. And so you're not just your actual tasks and your practices shift, but the way you apply them and where your focus is shifts, but most importantly, your identity shifts. Often the challenge is when people, and you see it a lot when people come up into senior roles or where they get that much aspired to seat at the table, what they miss is you also have to shift your identity once you're at that table. You're no longer campaigning. You are now part of the establishment. Yeah. Or how do you take up that role? And how do you now work with that? And hold on to any anxiety that you might have, because a lot of us inherently have an anti-establishment bias. We inherently, for right or wrong, might be biased, but we believe it can be better. It might just be basic frustration, optimistic hope. It could be better. Cool. That's great. However, to work with others, you also need to pull them in, invite them in. And so that role shifts when you're at that top table, if that's where you aspire to go. And there's no need to aspire to go there because that is a different task and job. It's not a position. Leadership is an act. That's always the key thing.
Another great thing I like talking about with leadership with you is I work very hard to be a good leader. I am 100% sure, Brett, that I do not lead the same way that you do, that my style is not the same. There are probably some very, hopefully there are some, you know, core aspects of it that are similar, but it's not about being you as a leader. It is about finding who you are as a leader and using that authenticity and those strengths to be the best leader. And the best leader you can be is based on who you are. I think that that's a really powerful and important aspect as well.
And do you have an idea how you articulate what is your leadership style? Who are you as a leader? Do you have your own leadership archetype?
I mean, it's not as nicely laid out as yours, but yeah, I mean, I think when I think about it, I always say that my teams, they take the work seriously, but not themselves. High on transparency, low on blame, big on building trust so that you don't just trust me, but that you trust the people around you to do their role. That is such a powerful place in building that space where people can feel like who really trust each other is, I think for me, one of the things that I work really hard to do. And because I am also let's do this. Let's do it fast. Let's do lots of stuff. I love brainstorming and being creative and all of those pieces, recognizing others need different kinds of structure, right? But really helping ensure that I will push the team hard to be the best they can be, but I will also try to deliver a great deal of fun as we do it. There's almost nothing, Brett, I can't turn into a game. Just that is... My team will tell you that. That is very true.
That sounds fun. Let's sign up to your team.
Yes.
No, I love your point though. So, you know, thinking other kinds of, was it needs of others?
Yes.
You know, and what you've articulated there is empathy, right? Thinking about the situation through the shoes of others, through the eyes of others, right? So empathy applies externally, but actually effective leaders apply it internally within your organization and develop your hypotheses of like, okay, why is this person I thought would be contributing a lot not contributing? Mm-hmm. Why is this person acting out, lashing out, being really disruptive? What's going on there? Versus, stop it, I'm really pissed off.
Right. Yes.
Which is a normal reaction to a lot of us because we don't necessarily know where those reactions come from unless you do the work. Because how we lead in the present is shaped by our past. Past experiences determine how we lead today. And that is powerful, but it can also be very destructive because we often aren't aware of what influences we have in the past that influences how we lead today. And that can be knowledge and experience, but often is pivotal moments in our life, whether that's early bosses, early figures in your community, could be teachers, school groups, and even, of course, the first organization we're all part of, called our family, right? And it's not to say that everything goes back to our mom and dad, but there may be, and there constantly are in my work with leaders where we do activities where we evaluate a current situation and compare the good and bad moments, and we have a tool that I use to do that. We then do other work of like, okay, in that situation, you felt really idealized as a leader. People thought you had magical solutions as a designer to come up with the perfect solution. Part of you liked that, which is good. Another part of you was terrified by it. And you started to self-sabotage and withdraw or even lash out. And then often you do the work, you find out, oh, okay, so somebody earlier in your career was, let's say, a really good boss who was idealized out in public, but in behind, they were a terrible bully. Therefore, when you feel idealized, you start to get terrified, you're going to become a bully. Therefore, you act out and you sabotage the situation and you walk. Basically, you create an exit for you. All subconsciously, you're trapped in your past experience. And it's amazing when those little moments surface, it's just like such a relief and it's a simple dot connected. And then it's usually very simple path forward, but it's hard to go back to do the link to create those personal insights of, I noticed I responded like this. My inference as to why is an earlier boss or this experience or that teacher triggered my response in the present based upon something that happened in the past. It's not always easy. Like a lot of the time, maybe you just are annoyed. But to develop as a leader, it's figuring out those hot buttons. Because then, as you use the term superpower, I love, you really understand the origin of your superpower and its limits, but also where it goes out of line and where it can accidentally cause great damage and harm.
And it does. I think that's really valid too. Like, because if you're just aware of it, if you can understand the piece, just that little bit of knowledge helps you put it in perspective, helps you step back from the emotions of it, right? Because it's triggering like an emotional memory that you don't recognize. And if you do recognize it, then it is far easier to put everything in perspective and be like, oh, that's why that's feeling like that. It's not, let's separate that feeling from what's actually occurring in this situation and see if I can manage that differently.
Exactly. And that's, as you develop as a leader, you tune that ability because it becomes a really powerful sensor of like, what's going on with this team? What's going on with the organization? How come when I'm presenting to leadership, I get really frustrated or they get frustrated? How do I read into that, understand it better? What's going on there? And then over time, how do I develop practices and tactics to work with their anxiety? Because naturally, new things, all of us, one hand, we love it, but then it's there. We're like, I'm not so sure about it. Like,
right.
I'm in Vancouver and I bought a new paddle board and I'm like, I've done it before. I haven't done it in 10 years, but I'm like, all right, exciting. I'm going to go out. I went out to the beach. It's a beautiful night. And I get out on it. I stand up. I'm like, oh, this is really wobbly. I really wanted to do this, but this is not my fantasy. This is weird. Of course, you just chill out and I give it a couple minutes. And it's fine. But it's the exact same thing in corporates where it's like, you know, the big presentation at the end of a sprint or the end of a project initiative, research, whatever the phase is. And it's like, hey, here's the prototype. It's working. Someone's like, but what is that? You know, that natural, and that's not a rejection. That's the natural process of learning of like, oh, I didn't know it could be done different. You've done it different. That means I have to slowly process and let go of all the ways we've done it in the past so I can start to internalize and understand how you've done it. And of course, like everything, a whole whack of personal anxieties are emerging of like, what's this mean for my role, my department? Is this a threat? Is it a friend? Whatever, all happening in an instant. But as you say, once you can start to become aware of that, it doesn't mean you shut it down, but you use it as a force for good. There are insights and signals of like, okay, that one, natural reaction, but let it pass. Like all leaders, for example, frustration is a common one. All leaders in all roles, in all departments, in all professions are frustrated. It's just... Therefore, frustration itself isn't the problem. It's what type of frustration. Is it constructive of like, I'm worried, how are we going to do this? Let me think it through. Or is it destructive? I'm overwhelmed. I can only think about this black and white. It's all delusionally magical thinking, or it's all cynical and terrible and bad. And that's the bad version of frustration.
Yeah.
The good version is optimistic hope, realistic hope around, it's not as good as it could be now, but I think it can be better. Here's how we can do this. I tell you why. Aspirational discontent. And that's where, you know, that you develop that ability to be kind, positive, empowering, but still also high standards, high performing, high expectations.
When my team would also tell you that one of my favorite sayings is that we're just going to pitch our tent in the Valley of Hope, right? Like it doesn't mean like it's the only, but like that's the mindset. That's the base camp we're going to start from. Because if we don't start from there, I can make things fail. That is not an issue, right? It's also just a much happier place to be for me. My persona.
Most people thrive in that. Like, you know, one of the stories that we sort of had thought about in advance, and we wrote, there's an online with the Pragmatic Institute, there's an online version of this, but it often, what you're saying reminds me of the team when we were working with Apple before the Apple Watch was publicly launched. And I had a team, we were set up with Jaguar Land Rover, and the task was to be the first car that could be controlled on a watch in the Apple Watch. So firstly, 50 years of science fiction becoming real. You can start a car on your wrist. Secondly, opportunity to work with Apple. Thirdly, as part of one of their biggest launches in the last decade, behind the scenes before it's public. Super exciting, but also incredibly terrifying because you have, you know, at one of the leading organizations in the world, opportunity to redefine what is automotive design in the industry, period. Because at that time, digital design was pretty poor compared to what it is now. It wasn't that elegant. It didn't look luxury. And a company like Jaguar Land Rover, which at the time was winning a ton of design awards for the vehicles, there's a real second-class citizen vibe around the digital design team, where not only did they feel like, you know, almost in a defensive way, like, oh, we're not that good. We're just down here. The rock stars, the car designers who design curves and how light hits glass and are absolute masters at that, were treated as the rock stars. There's kind of this defensive position around, well, you know, we're just digital, fine, whatever. But we're like, well, no, this is Apple Watch. We're Jaguar Land Rover. We can elevate the standards here. And we believe that with this team, we can do it. So we, as you say, pitched our tent in the Valley of Hope, and we started, and we believe we can do that. And it was a wonderful start to the project. So that reinforces the point that you made. However, as we got going, reality hits. And so the team started empowered, feeling very motivated, self-organizing, very energized. And about a third of the way in, and we had a very clear deadline of the public release when Tim Cook was walking onto stage to say, here's the watch and the ecosystem of phenomenal apps that demonstrate how great the world is. We had one problem. We were designing, both from a visual and also technical perspective, for a device we couldn't have. So normally at this phase, you would have at least a prototype, at least an emulator. We didn't have any of this. And we expected that at the early stage we'd have it. And even Apple's evangelists, who are the partners that you work with early stage, who have a direct pipeline into the design team in Cupertino, they were incredibly frustrated because they normally would have it themselves, but they just didn't. So we're like, okay, this is pretty bad. So we're pretty frustrated. And I remember the meeting we walked into. So it's like, okay, we're, you know, the CTO and I, we're the tent pole in the tent of hope in the valley. And we walk in and we're like, you know, we ourselves had no idea how we were going to get out of this, but we were in the team, we were with the group. And one of the young software engineers said, you know, I've seen some of the demo videos. I understand iOS. I can speculate how it would work for a watch kit. Our designer had already done this from a design perspective, looking at the design systems and could deconstruct the grid on the watch and knowing how the Apple Watch, but also interlay that with Jaguar Land Rover's design system. Like, for a couple screens, it's a lot of work to do, but it was impressive. But then in a way, inspired by the peer, the software engineer said, you know, I think I can make a technical emulator that could allow us to at least progress and validate some of the assumptions that we have until we get access. So in this stage, this is where CTO and I, who yes and people naturally were like, yeah, yes, but what about, but we stopped that. And like, okay, what are some of the assumptions you have in there? All right. What other perspectives might you need from a technical perspective? Who can we bring in? We also, you know, said, you know, we each shared experiences of like, we've had similar times where we understand this moment and it's probably quite anxious for you and you probably feel real stressed. But the one thing we know is that if we work together and we have the capabilities in the room and we will get the resources we need, that we can get through this. And we don't know what's going to come. Change is constant. Things are always emerging, but you know, we've got you. We'll progress. And most importantly, though, it was that last bit, and especially to this young designer. Imagine that 2 years into your career, you're being this critical requirement as part of one of the most exciting product launches in the world that year with arguably the most innovative company in the world. And he said, you know, if you believe you can do this, we support you and we believe you can too. Words of affirmation. You know what you're doing. We've tested out what your thinking is. We accept it might not work out. We hold that. But you do what you do and you go for it. And lo and behold, over the next 4 weeks, they developed it. We were able to do the technical testing, the design testing and all that, such that then when the actual emulator came, which oddly, we only had a couple of weeks before the actual watch was in our hands as well, we were actually able to hit the timeline that very few of the other companies were able to do and be part of the launch. And so the timeline, but more importantly, high, high quality, high craft. And it came back to in those, not just the beginning, but I always like that moment, that meeting where the individuals had the capabilities, a ton of anxiety and frustration, but through the practice of transformation leadership, which you were alluding, that's what you were doing when you're talking about your leadership style. It's the practice of transformation leadership of how do you empower others. And empowerment comes from within. It's not because I say you're empowered. You feel empowered. You step up and take the authority that's been granted to you. So in this case, this software engineer, we grant him the authority. Do it. Use the resources. We believe in you. And he stepped up, took it, and did the work. And that's where, you know, those six practice transformational leadership is a very powerful, and I think it naturally fits with a lot of designers around how to support others in their work. Because, you know, very few of us really think in an isolated island. We work with others, and we want everyone else to be at our level and perform their best. And developing a transformational leadership practice, which has strong evidence, some recent research came out in December around it, is arguably one of the most effective leadership styles alongside authentic leadership, is a great practice, which I think what the story tells us for designers, it's really easy to adopt that because there's some specific practices, there's six of them, but it all comes back from empathy, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to understand your colleague and imagining what they're going through at that time and developing the right things to support them, but still be realistic and still have high standards.
I love that too, because I do think like often people think empowerment is like, you know, anointing them, like I will knight you and you will now be empowered. I think what you talk about there is both like ensuring they have the resources, right? And ensuring they have the access. But I think the most powerful part of it too is we know it's may not be perfect. And I accept that, right? You don't have to worry about that, because it is a known piece and I know you will do your best and we'll be as close as we can be. Yeah. And that is a really safe space for someone to push themselves and to really do feel empowered, right? It's not perfection or you failed. And I do think it's something that it's critical. It's critical as a good leader.
It's critical. And you know, with the thing with psychological safety, like empowerment, it's not just saying you are safe. It's not just saying you're empowered, but you have to read the situation and allow uncertainty, anxiety, and frustration to come up. And when I say allow, it doesn't mean to tolerate, to say that that's how we work, but to be very sympathetic, to imagine. Mm-hmm. If I was in your shoes, I would also be a little bit frustrated or skeptical or dubious or worried or have another point of view. You just need to air out because you know what? It might be right. Or it's just part of their process of how they're coping with the moment, based upon, you know, who they are and their experience. Because that ability to not just take up that power, but also to hold the uncertainty and to share that uncertainty. And uncertainty isn't just like, I feel scared, but it can also be, hey, we tried this before and it didn't work. Therefore, I'm a bit skeptical. Okay, thank you for sharing that. Let's unpack that. Why is that? What can we learn from that? And that's your job as a leader, is to work with that and to unpack that and to process it, because there might be some important information, or it might be the individual genuinely is just scared and needs reassuring and comforting, and to work through that. And that's the, you know, the innovation in highly emotional situations, because there's a lot at risk from not just from a commercial perspective, from a personal perspective. Could be role, could be job, could be performance review. It can also be your self-image, your identity. Like for me, that moment where walking in the room and this dream project to work with Apple and to be part of the launch, it was about to die. It was possible annihilation. And it's terrible. However, our job as leaders is to contain our own stuff. We talked about it on the side, right? That was our task. But then, so we go into the room. And this is always a thing, like, you know, with empowered teams and as a leader of a team or as a leader-like member in a team, like partly why I thought that was a great leadership example of not so much what we were doing, but what that individual did in the team. Because that individual stepped into a leadership role amongst the peers, the team leader. And it's kind of a concept that bounces around. I always call quantum leadership, where you can be a leader or a follower or sometimes both.
Yep.
And so the CTO and I, we had to step aside and just hold our non-positionness and to empower that individual from authority, but also from them, from within their self-motivation, so they could go ahead and do the work, which turned out to be fantastic and a lot of fun. And I'll always have a smile whenever I think of that rainy day where the ice white Jaguar, was it F-Type, was in Shoreditch. And the first time it touched a watch and it went to the satellites and the computers and back into the car. And, you know, it roared to life like a hungry lion.
Nice. All right. So when we talk about empowerment, what are things that people who are listening, if they want to practice their empowerment, what are some like hints that you would give?
Well, there's the six specific practices, right? And this is what's great, is that you can practice these quite literally and practice. Well, I use practice like a sports, right? You can beforehand, but you need to practice under different circumstances, different conditions, find your own flavor of it. And the six practices are question critical assumptions, because that's helpful. It's reassuring. words of affirmation, right? So that's helping people see their strengths and focuses on what they can do, not what they can't do. Really focus on words of affirmation. Seeking different perspectives. So this helps people build confidence in their creative thinking abilities and builds linkage. Teaching valuable life lessons. So that's sharing a little bit of your own vulnerability and authenticity, because often, yes, we can think our way through these situations, but understanding, even just hearing someone else has been there before, even if it's not the same, it's very reassuring. And also there may be interesting or relevant bits of information, but that way you're sharing why you think that. Or like I say, it's just an illustration, but it's a very effective and efficient teaching tactic rather than saying, do this.
Yes.
Okay, but no, teach me what we should do. A, so I understand it, or B, maybe I can elaborate on it. Perfect. The fifth one is introduce followers to development opportunities. So that opportunity where that leader stepped up was also a development in their career, right? So they then started to learn how to have more of a voice. And we encouraged that, and we ensured that that individual had space around the sides. We were also checking in with the other individuals and making sure that they were comfortable, they didn't feel threatened, but also that it's like, hey, isn't this great? We can support this individual like we supported you earlier. And it's like, oh yeah, you're right. Isn't that cool? We're all growing. And it was wonderful for team morale dynamics. So fifth one is introduce followers to development opportunities. And the sixth is present different perspectives. And this is just a way of exposing your own analytical and problem-solving practices. A, it's relevant, but then B, you're role modeling. And others just soak up a lot from that.
Mm-hmm.
Presenting different perspectives. And the key word is presenting perspectives, not recommendations and directives, but it's like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing there. There's also this perspective and that perspective. And you're just showing lateral thinking, not again to say do this, but to expand. Because often the individuals are really good at the convergence part in these sorts of initiatives, whereas you're helping provide a little bit broader perspective and point of view that may generate more creativity in them because they'll start to build on it. And then they start to own it and they feel it. Because really what you're trying to do is just hand over like a little gift that they can pick up and to make into an amazing present, you know, into something big. Because most people have extraordinary capabilities. It just need those little bits to unlock it.
I like that too in that example. I think presenting two different perspectives, doesn't have to be two, but multiple ones starts to feel a little bit less like there's this or there's that, right? And it really is a signal to start to think about how many different options, how many layers and perspectives are there. And again, if we model that, if we model the vulnerability to bring up different ideas, but that's what we want, right? It's what we want from our team members is to bring their ideas and to question ours. We want that to our core. And also many people don't believe us. And I guess a better put is saying, I want you to argue with me is not enough, right? Saying, no, it's okay if you don't like it, tell me what you think, isn't enough. What you're talking about is I have to show it. I have to show them that I mean it by creating an atmosphere, by demonstrating these behaviors that empower them to do it.
And empower and to be self-aware of what's your motivation. Is it, I want to argue because I want to win? Or is it, let's debate to see what's the best answer. And so I can help develop you and evolve your problem-solving ability as you will develop the answer. And that's that middle career stage, which is often a crux for a lot of designers, where they work to the hard, good years of working out, how do I get to the right answer? How do I do all that rigor to get to the right answer? And that's a very important stage to get to, in particular around the director stage, I've got the right answer. But as you go further, then it's how do I help others get to the right answer? Now, of course, there's switching depending on the context. So as you go more senior, if you're moving into an executive presentation context, you're back to, I have the answer, right? And then, yes, that's where the resistance comes. And then your task becomes less about, I got to the right answer, to here's the answer my team has. Now I'm going to work with you, dear executive team, board, whatever, to start to think about different perspectives, to elaborate what we have here. What does it mean for the business so that you don't just say, here's what I don't like about that thing? Because it's not about the thing. It's about them and their position. So that same transformational leadership practice we applied into the team, we can start to apply up and out into the organization. So when you're at that table, the much aspired to seat at the table, that practice applies there as well, but to a different audience.
Love it. All right. And I know we're going to touch on a couple other really smart. I'm excited. Okay. So we talked about empowerment, what it is, a great story example of why it's so important and why it's so powerful. And it's much more than what we say. It's what we do in the, then sort of the atmosphere we create. We talked about the six practices. And I think to your point, it is practice, right? Even when you think, I finally got this one, you will mess it up one time, or maybe it's just me, could be, right? And then you'll be like, oh, I struck out that time and I will not do that again, right?
Yeah. I'll try it this way. Slightly different next time.
Yeah. Maybe that. So, okay. What's the second one? What's the second part?
Well, the second one we talked about, which is a question that people often come to me, right? The first question is around, how can I empower my team? So we've addressed that. The second one I often get is, why can't my organization change?
Yes.
Often said like that. Why can't my organization?
Very frustrated that they won't change, right?
Feel the frustration.
We know where we should be and they will not come along with us.
Darn it. I'd seen the future. It's great. and no doubt you have. But this goes back to that, framing back to that earlier point where frustration is quite universal in organizations, right? So I really strongly feel that design is one of the best places from which innovation comes from. And a lot of what design does, even if it's a small improvements and change, is a form of innovation. It's the realization of new ways of doing things. And one of the frustrating things in organizations is frustration. It's 94% of executives are frustrated with innovation, which is important when 96% of companies have innovation as a priority. Therefore, all leaders are frustrated. So when you start to ask the question, well, why isn't there more change? Well, you actually have to look at why is there so much frustration in organizations and what does that look like? And in the context of design and product development, what I often think is that one of the real challenges of leadership is that constant tension between divergence and convergence. It makes a lot of sense in the double diamond, but you have to remember what's it like in the room when you're actually doing it. And this is where that frustration with change is actually a frustration to understand one's role and how to switch it depending on the phase within divergence and convergence. So executives and other aspects of business are typically really developed and trained around the dual roles of leadership, right? There's the charismatic role and the architectural role. And let me share an example of what I mean by that in practice. So I've had the privilege of being a number of leadership teams of exceptional design studios, and then also working with other design studios in the room when they're doing their strategy work. And I always think back to one scenario, this is kind of a composite of different ones, but often they come to, you know, the leadership offsite of a team of designers who run a design team. And there may be some other capabilities in there, but typically it's very dominated by designers. And you have the 2-day leadership offsite, the annual planning, and the first day is usually excellent. It's the looking at the problem analysis. What are the key questions and assumptions? What are some hypotheses? How might we do this? Putting together the narrative. Basically, interestingly, often, what's the presentation look like internally? But you're doing the work of strategy, which is great. What's really interesting is day two, when it comes to not so much the conception of strategy, but moving into realization. How do we start to own this? Who does what? How are we accountable? A lot of resistance starts to emerge because what they're starting to be asked about is not the design questions. They're actually starting to around organizational realization. And that's where that day one is the charismatic part. Charismatic leadership is empowering, envisioning, and energizing. Those are three components of charismatic leadership. The second part of leadership is the architectural part, which is designing, rewarding, and controlling. And that is actually beyond design process. When they say designing, it's about what are the systems, the services, what are the components of the organization of how it works? Some fields of design are naturally attuned to this. So service design naturally is quite attuned to this. Systems designers, organizational design, they're very good at the architectural part. But as you become a senior leader, the ability to switch between those roles, or at least be aware you naturally gravitate towards one. And I find a lot of designers naturally gravitate and are naturally exceptional at the charismatic part of leadership. So the empowering others through visions, prototypes, ideas, crafted products, inspiring things, really good research, insight. That's all in empowering of others of like, that's an amazing insight. We can do something with that. Or envisioning a future product, a scenario, whatever, and energizing people through that process. You know, most organizations, the design meeting is the most exciting part. You know, if you're a chief executive, a CFO, it's like, this is the exciting part. But that ability then to shift, also know when to shift into architectural role as you become more senior is really important. So if you are on a broader organizational leadership team in a corporate or on a board, to not just check out when it becomes around, all right, well, what are the compensation systems? How does that work? Or how are we going to worry about the route to market? Well, you may not lead that, but you also still need to pay attention, but also need to be aware of that. You then have an opportunity to empower the others as they take forward what your recommendations are. And some designers are really good at saying, actually, I really care about the supply chain. I'm going to be really involved in that. And that's great too, but they often are less naturally charismatic. There is a certain breed that are exceptionally good charismatic and architectural leaders. And this comes out of fields like law as well, finance, you know, you'll get that rare breed. But most of us naturally gravitate to one of the two. And by being really self-reflective of that, it enables you to then either develop those other skills or to be aware of where, you know, it's great to hand off. And, you know, I intellectually like the systems part and, you know, service design intellectually, but to actually go through it, I really struggle. It's just, I'm not wired that way. I'm naturally more in the empowering, visioning, and energizing. Therefore, when I'm in the other space, I still definitely try to add value, but I really relax and realize that actually this is an opportunity for this other person to shine, and together we'll make a super duo of charismatic and architectural leader.
I think one of the things that's really interesting about that is often people are like, oh, I can do both roles. And you can do both roles, right? And you may do them both fairly well. But there is one that feeds your soul. Like there is the one that makes the little butterflies in your stomach, because it is exciting. It is absolutely what feeds you. And that is your core one. And the other one you may have varying degrees of, I can suck it up and get it done. But that is in fact what kind of what you're doing, right? You are doing the best. And I think it is really important that to turn sort of inspiration into change takes a lot of systems, a lot of architecture. And I think you're absolutely right that often you get frustrated because you're like, but this is the right vision. And the architect's like, yeah, but you don't understand the 50 steps that come in between that great idea and making it a reality. And if it doesn't feel like you have any understanding of that or even appreciation, then it's also very frustrating for the architect, because they're going to have to bridge that gap. They want a partner who they can say, hey, do you know that this is a thing? And that person goes, oh, no, that's interesting. Well, like, let's figure out how to solve it. And I think it's understanding which one you are. And just like you said, it is recognizing the importance of the other, that change doesn't happen unless both of those things are really in place.
Exactly. And what's really helpful with that is digging down to understand not which one you gravitate towards, but also situationally in the real world, how you respond. So if I go back to that story around the design team, department, agency, offsite, the second day it was the architectural phase, yet a lot of them associated that management stuff as a bunch of BS, a bunch of bureaucracy, a bunch of crap, really. Sorry if that word's wrong. Try to use that word, not a more aggressive word, which you can imagine comes out of people's mouths. So their own identity and self-image of being anti-establishment and not being, you know, doing that leadership crap where they sit in rooms all the day. Well, they were doing that. They were doing strategy. They were a leadership team, and their self-image was really threatened. As one of the hypotheses for a couple of people, that was why they were lashing out. They really just inherently are not wired to be part of a team. And once they learned that was helpful, because then they had the power to make a choice. Do I want to become part of a leadership team? Or actually, am I a better just craftsperson and a great practitioner who can guide a great design team versus build a great design organization? And once that decisions emerge and the data, because it's real world data, right? How did you respond in that situation? It's really powerful insight, A, to maybe explain some frustration or some hypotheses they have around what leadership is, what the organization is. But then it develops the insight to empower them to make the decision. Okay, do I actually want to do that? Or do I get my energy from something else? And that's actually quite a beautiful thing, I think. And it's the problem is when people are conflicted, and that's when the maladaptive responses happen, when you see the lashing out, or worse, one of the most violent acts of organizations, indifference and silence.
Nobody wants that.
No, withdrawal is very common, right?
Yeah.
And sure, it can be a power move, but often it's a form of fight or flight. And it's withdraw, a form of overwhelm and stepping back. And it's just as violent as lashing out and anger, but they're very different patterns. But coming from the same place becomes black and white thinking, opting out, rejecting something about the system, often linked back to their identity, their self-image of who they are, their self-image of what kind of work they're doing.
All right. So if we want to help people practice how to help realize change, what are the things they should practice?
Well, I think the biggest thing to start with realizing change is being aware of your own identity as a leader. Mm-hmm. This is where starting to think about, how am I showing up here? Am I here today to show up, to be charismatic, to create energy and opportunity? Or is this about No, this is the divergent phase. It's about narrowing it down and really thinking of designing, rewarding, controlling, and sticking that. And then whatever your anxiety, like thinking about where am I happiest? Mm-hmm. Developing tactics of like, I'll really focus on that bit. And then where you don't get energy, I'll say, I'll stay involved. I'll be more supportive of others in that mm-hmm. bit. Very simple self-awareness. Like if you think back to diverge and converge, which one gives me energy? And I'll focus most of my energy on that one. That's where I'll get my validation of being a great professional. And then the other phase, that's where I'll support someone else.
Yeah. All right. Now we've run the last one. We've actually talked about a couple different times already, right? I think it's a huge part of, it's why you talk about your persona. It's why you know your persona. And it's a huge part of what makes us really good leaders and really helps us be the most productive we can be. I also think it helps us in the long run be as happy as we can be. And that's self-awareness. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, self-awareness is a really close cousin to transformational leadership, right? So transformative leadership is helping others self-motivate. Authentic leadership is being self-aware of your motivations and able to articulate them to others so they understand where you're coming from. And it's a really powerful way to build trust, but also comprehension, because we understand through experiences of others and their motivations much, much better and deeper than through the logic of why we're doing something. So if you're able to say, here's why I'm excited about this, or here's why I'm a bit worried or why I'm concerned because of this aspect of me, it could be logical. It could also be just experiential. That's a very powerful way to build trust. Mm. And like a scenario that emerges a lot in my work, this is sort of from my one-on-one work where it's quite evident. And this is, we're sort of pulling together a few threads here with this one where, there's quite a number of individual CEOs of exceptional design studios I've worked with. And they have a common pattern where, and we've touched on this already, where they're trying to turn around or elevate their next phase of the studio, and they go into their leadership team meeting or session and they start with a really clear vision. And then they slowly withdraw and the rest of the team takes over and vision and clarity goes away, which is very confusing to these individuals because mm-hmm. they're like, well, I'm so visionary. I do this amazing work. I have points of view. People ask me, how come I can't do that with my own team? And there's one in particular I remember where she had this exceptional R&D lab that was doing some very powerful work that everyone uses in what they do on a daily basis. And she was super frustrated about why that kept happening. And so this is where when I talk about reflection and looking back at your own data, this is at the core of being an authentic leader. It's really understand your own motivations, not just saying I'm intrinsically motivated, but why and what causes that. And so what we do, and I did with this leader and what I'll do with a lot of individuals when they're in that really quite a trapped state, but it can be done when you're also in a great state. It doesn't have to be at that end of frustration on the verge of burnout or distress, is you go back and you take two experiences, a good experience and a bad experience of leadership. What were they like? And this is how athletes work, right? You don't just look at the perfect case study. You go back and analyze, okay, in the middle of the match, I had the same situation emerge twice. I responded differently each time. What was going on there? And I developed a tool called the Innovation Leadership Map, where we look at the six dimensions of your outlook, your identity, exposure, empowerment, risk, and actualization. And it forms a bit of a grid, and there's specific markers that you have. And when you go through that, when you're in a situation like that leader I was describing, she has that response to idealization. So we touched on this a bit earlier, but this is where we have the observation, and then we do the deeper work, where there's specific activities like leadership biography. You ask yourself, what was a leadership role model when I was 6 years old, 16 years old, 26 years old, and 36 years old, or 46, depending on your age? What was a leadership role model? Also, what was a leadership experience I had? And it's amazing how that exercise, just sitting there and doing your leadership biography, brings up either imprints of what a good or a bad leader is, but also experiences that often are blind spots or limiters. So that individual leader, and this has happened quite a few times, had a particular teacher who was in contrast to another teacher that they loved. Often the 6 or 8 year old or the earlier phases, they're really warm, wonderful. It's sort of the mid-teen ones. There's often your first experience with really bad leadership and often has a really profound imprint. And therefore you can draw that direct link to that behavior that in the room seemed very confounding to that leader, confounding to the team. The team is like, where's the vision? Man, you're really good at this stuff. And it helps explain that. And when you get those moments that then you start to unpack, okay, what was motivating me in those moments that I wanted, but I wasn't getting from that leader. Mm-hmm. And it's three primary, what are called, this is a bit technical, motivating anxieties. Now, anxiety sounds bad, but actually anxiety can be and is a very good thing. It's a natural thing. It's what compels us to do stuff. And so there are three primary motivating anxieties. You can remove the word anxiety, but just motivations. There's control anxiety, which is, I want to feel safe. There's validation anxiety, I want to know I'm good. And there's death anxiety, I want to know I matter. So it's a legacy question. And most of us, if you just intuitively respond to it, you'll say, yeah, for me, it's validation. For me, it really matters to know that I'm good, that what I'm doing is good. I'm a good person. And that's my personal story. And once I see that, then I have particular experiences in the past where I sought that from others, or they gave it to me and that was good, or I didn't get it from people and that was bad. It explained why I would get frustrated. I didn't perform my best. I'd lose energy. And that is how I'm able to articulate to people, like, you know, the Apple Watch project, for example. I'm like, you know, it really matters to me that this is really good. Right? And I want external validation. Is that right? I don't know, but that just is. Someone else is like, well, I want to know that I'm safe. I don't care about how good it is. That's mm-hmm. I want to know I'm safe. Or someone else says, I really want to have a legacy. This is my last project in my career. I want it to be awesome in my portfolio. And once you are able to articulate those things, it creates a much more personal connection, because that authenticity demonstrates a little bit of self-awareness and a bit of vulnerability. And it comes from a place that you're comfortable with, because I understand why and I can decide how much to share and let people in to understand my motivations, which as you're a senior leader, and if you look around and pay attention to some, like it can be used very cynically. You'll see that sometimes, and this is where some leaders, some designers will shy away from leadership because it can be used quite cynically. You can see when the stories are overcrafted in narrative. That's a different person, right? And if you come back to the data that you get from analyzing a good and bad experience, from looking down at your leadership biography, as well as understanding your motivating anxiety, what you're forming isn't just a persona, but actually an archetype. And I really like, and this is the point to take from this story here, is around a very powerful thing to develop as a leader is your own individual leadership archetype. And why I like the archetype is it's slightly disassociated from yourself. And it becomes like it literally becomes a role you play. And it allows you to be more experimental and playful. I strongly personally believe it's important to be very authentic. It's just for most of us, we're a lot happier when we're authentic. It helps us square the dots around, okay, where do I get energy? It allows me to think through what are my best capabilities? What are my maybe weakest capabilities? But then be honest about that and then decide, do I develop those or do I just really double down on my strengths? And then it allows then the practice plan to emerge. So what I've just sort of talked through there is how, as you develop as a leader, to develop your identity is to think of the end point of like, okay, how do I get the data to form where I am now, you know, today in the job I'm doing? What's a great leadership archetype I could draft for myself? And, you know, I do it with my clients. They actually have a little archetype board of who they are, associative images of what that person looks like. And it's incredibly clarifying and empowering. And it's really playful because then, you know, if whatever the character is or the person it is, you have concrete practices. It's linked authentic to who you are. You can articulate it to others. I'm not saying you tell your archetype to others, but you can reveal the little bit when it's relevant. And it's a very powerful and grounding exercise to develop your leadership practice.
The other reason I think that's really powerful, and I think one of the best things we can do for our team is to be a consistent type of leader. Now, that doesn't mean if you're doing something bad, you shouldn't change. Of course, I don't mean that. But like, you know, part of being authentic, or even if you opt not to be, but consistent, they know what to expect. They know how you're going to approach things is really important for them to feel, to have that experience of trust and to feel empowered within that environment. If you keep shifting and being a different kind of boss at different times, that's really hard.
It's very hard. And to build on that, if you are in a situation where in your role, you have to show up differently in different contexts. So imagine you have a design studio in a large corporate, you come into the design studio, you're checking out the work, you're visionary, you're empowering, you're authentic. And then you head up to the executive floor and you have to do the financial review and fight for your budget next year. Those are different archetypes. And for some leaders, it's really powerful to actually develop 2, 3, even 4, depending on they do. So when they walk, quite literally walk into the room, they're like, okay, I'm going from Ted Lasso to now Iron Man, right?
And that's a really good mental model too, right? Like when we're talking to the board and some of the things that makes you a great team leader is not what's going to be, doesn't mean you're changing who you are. It's that you're leaning in to the right parts of who you are for that audience.
Exactly. And you think through not just who you are, but how do they see you? Mm-hmm. What do they want from you? Right. So we haven't gone into the leader follower dynamic, but you know, people want something from their leaders, whether they're aware of it or not. And then when you are a design leader going into the executive room, they want to project something onto you. There's the person and then there's the person in the role. And they're two different things. Sometimes the role and person are the same, but typically most of us, imagine you become the design director or chief design officer of a company. Someone's held that role before. And then you are stepping into it. And so it's partly it's you, that's authentic, but also think of the role and what everyone else is looking at from you. So if the chief design officer is seen as the savior to the company, either A, excellent, work with that, or B, it's a bit delusional. So I have to work out, how am I going to disappoint them and cool down their hope that we're going to, you know, magically solve their pain and problem from a structural issue that is outside the scope of design? Or if it is, you know, I gave that example earlier in Scandinavia, design was the magical idealized entity to drive change. And we knew that and we worked with it and people needed hope and needed something to idealize and to give them confidence and pride. And so we leaned into that. So when we would go into the top management forums, executive teams, whether it's myself or my team colleagues on the executive group within the design studio, we would lean into that. We were entirely about hope. There was no convergence and technicality around it. It was just hope. Whereas other situations, like, no, we got to fight for the ROI. And we're going to be just as tough as you in this situation, because it's the right thing for our end customers. It's the right thing for great design. It's the right thing for our team.
I think it's really interesting when you've talked about sort of change and self-awareness and some degree empowerment, that there is, you need to know yourself. You will always be yourself, but what role you're playing and how you do it will need to change by the situation you're in. Like, that is true. And you should embrace that and understand it and what those implications are versus, you know, sort of naively being like, but this worked here, so I could do it there, right? That's how you're going to be able to be the best leader.
Be the best leader. And over time, really develop that real-time capacity to analyze that and to think about the situation in parallel perspectives at the same time. What I mean by that is that there's the concept, and this is maybe a way to sort of wrap up these three different threads that we've talked about, is what we're getting at is how do you develop your leadership practice? So yes, you have your capabilities, you have your craft, but then how do you start to treat your leadership practice as a craft itself? And we've talked about that through a few different areas around empowerment, managing change, as well as authentic leadership. What we're getting towards is trying to develop very self-aware and reflective leaders. And there's a lot of evidence that one of the most important drivers of effective senior leadership is self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And this is, you could take this from a design perspective as self-empathy. We touched on this earlier, but not, you know, we're very good at seeing the world through other people's shoes, right? From their shoes or through their eyes. But also you can develop that for yourself. And there's the premise of the dance floor on the balcony. So if you imagine a nightclub or a dance hall, there's a dance floor where everyone's in the throw and the mix of it, right? And that's the world of business. No matter how many org charts and PowerPoint slides we have, the actual reality is just this emergent array of human behavior and reality and decisions under the guise of logic. And you as a leader are in that. But if you can also at the same time have the perspective of the balcony looking down on it, then that helps you develop insight and understanding what's going on. And if you think of that yourself, of like, okay, what am I seeing here? If I was now a fly on the wall looking at me, what would I hypothesize around how I'm leading, why I'm leading this way, what's going on in me? And developing that parallel perspective when you're in the room or on stage, if you are presenting or in a around a wall with a team working on a problem, that can help you develop a lot of insight around how others respond to me, how am I responding to them, what's going on here, and you know, what's the best for the situation, what's the best for me, and what will give me energy and help us guide towards the vision that we have before us.
Nice. Love it. It's just really interesting as we've gone through this. It's very hard as someone who, again, really am passionate about being a good leader. It does not mean I am the best leader or that I'm perfect, right? But it really matters to me.
Yeah.
There is a lot of what I think is the most important part of my role is leadership. And it's so interesting as you talk about it to think about, right? All of the different pieces, the motivation, anxieties, like I am a clear validation as well. I am like, you give me a compliment, I will do anything from you from then on, right? Like I am that person. And I know that about myself. I also know that I have team members who distinctly are not that person. Yeah. and would prefer you never mention their name. And that's the both the ability to understand yourself, but to each individual you do, because what you need and what they need may not be the same. Finding places where there's good overlap, explaining the reasons why. Another place for me in my career has always been brainstorming. I love brainstorming. I don't need any rules. You don't have to tell me in advance. You stick me in a room. I like think this is a blast. And there are several members of my team that really, they shut down. There's not enough. Like they need to think ahead of time and be able to come. And like, I can't think ahead of time because I like, I get attached to my like thoughts or I go like too far down, right? This was like, this blew my mind that people don't like brainstorming. It makes complete sense when you think about it. Gosh, what a scary, vulnerable thing to do. But because it's so part, and I know that about myself, being able to recognize those things, recognize them, talk about it, find ways that really bridge both of us has been, I continue to work on it, but it is one of those things, again, as you walked through these, there's so many ways I could practice not only those situations, but other skills that will help me in all of those situations. So really great conversation.
Well, and continue to work on it. I mean, practice it, right? Because it's not like, it's not a thing we hold. It's a capability, the practiced capability and how you develop it. And what I love about your story there, and I'm glad that you shared your motivating anxiety. I wasn't going to put you on the spot. That would be unfair. Force you to reveal something in public. But, you know, that's that superpower of leadership, which is attending to the needs of others. So becoming aware, not everyone's like me. A is a big insight for a lot of people, but then B, the next level insight is starting to think through what is the need of others and why, and how do I engage with them? Because now as you become in a leadership role, which again, it's an act, driving change with others. If you're in a leadership role, you have a responsibility to attend to the needs of others. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean just because they have a need, that's right, but you have a responsibility to attend to it and to understand what's going on there. And consistently the evidence, and this has been researched since the Second World War around what makes effective teams, it all comes back to self-awareness and tending to the needs of others.
And the variety is important on the team, right? And yeah, you might be thinking, it would be so easy to manage a team of people who all, you know, that were validated the same way I was or liked to work, but that is not where we get the richest results or the richest experiences. It's worth the effort.
It's worth the effort, and it is increasingly the responsibility and duty of leadership as we embrace and we know, again, the evidence around, you know, the diversity in teams creates better teams. Mm-hmm. However, it also creates a greater duty and requirement on the leader to work with that.
Yes.
So how do you work with that in a constructive way? Just because there is diversity does not make a great team. It is a heightened practice around how do you make a great team out of that? Because that will be arguably better, maybe even the best team that's possible. Yep. But it's a different capability and practice. And every team will be unique based upon those specific individuals who are in it. And hence your self-empathy around how you're responding and empathy for others and attending to their needs and working the dynamic is the beautiful mix of leadership. And in a design and product environment, that's most of your job, actually. And the more you tend to that, the better the quality of work.
Absolutely. All right. Yeah. We talked about lots of different things today, Brett. And I have like a 3-page to-do list on myself. But what if you could have listeners do 2 things differently tomorrow based on what we talked about today, where would you focus them?
The first thing is to see yourself as a leader, right? And then the second thing is to start to think about how will I define my practice as a leader? So we've shared a number of specific things of practice, but I think the first thing is actually start to look in the mirror and see there's a leader. Sounds cheesy, but see yourself as one, but more importantly, then start to self-author what kind of leader do I want to be? Am I best at? And then you take the power.
Excellent. All right, Brett, this was fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing your story and your advice. If people want to learn more, where should we send them?
Well, you can come to my website, brettmcfarland.com. And I also have a newsletter, Connecting Dots, where it's a monthly look where we dive really quite deep. It's a bit of my own R&D and part of some of the research. And if there's anyone interested in the Innovation Leadership Map, what it is, how it works, there's an insights tab on my webpage, brettmcfarland.com.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And keep on your practice.
Thank you.
Seek that validation.
Yes. See right there. It was fun. Validated. All right. That's it for today's episode. Join us next time when we have another great topic, helping you make a more strategic impact as a designer. And if you're looking for more resources like this too, don't forget to check out pragmaticinstitute.com/design. Thanks for listening.